I guess we're starting now. For those of you who saw my session yesterday, you know that I do experiential learning, which means that I try to do an exercise with each lecture that I do that I hope will really dramatize the point that I'm trying to make. So we're going to be talking about the history of colorism in the United States. And what that is, colorism, is the different treatments that people of color get because of their skin tone. That a person of a lighter skin tone than I am would get a different treatment from me because of their skin tone. So what I'd like to do today to begin is to have you, and I'm so happy we got a good group here, line yourselves up in what you consider to be the most all-American looking person in the room and kind of go back. So I'll give you all a few minutes. All-American looking kind of person. Who is the most all-American looking and just kind of go back. I'll let you all do that. Let me say, to make this to the most stereotypical person, what does that mean? We have such a lively group. Thank you all. The reason I do this exercise is because we want to talk about the issue of colorism in the United States and the history of color prejudice in the United States. And to do that, you have to really begin to observe the differences in appearance of people of different races. So, now, blacks tend to generally have darker color, they have kinky hair, they have thick lips, they have wide, short noses. So that when I go to work, I'm always teased about where do my glasses really sit? Because you don't know, how is it, and you can probably see that they sit on my cheeks because they just don't fit, you know, and I've never been able to get a pair of glasses that don't sit there. So. But the reason that I bring up these characteristics of darker color, of kinky hair, of thick lips, of short, wide noses, is because these characteristics became part or associated with other things like low intelligence and lack of morals and a backward culture. And why really is it important that we examine this? And the reason we examine it now is because it has caused a caste system in the United States, even among people of color, even within people in the black community. And it can be traced back to slavery. And a lot of times when you're doing something on something that's very current of racism and colorism and stuff like that, people want to know, why can't you guys just leave slavery alone? Well, we can't leave slavery alone because we need to go back to slavery. We need to really examine the roots. We need to look at the roots so that we can really deal with some of the symptoms. When blacks were first enslaved in this country, they were treated the same as white indentured servants and treated the same as Native Americans who were captured. Later on, when slavery became a real money-making enterprise, and whites were allowed to work out their indentured servitude, and blacks were not, then they had to become a justification for slavery. And then people needed to start to justify why black people were slaves. And so this was usually done with two major justifications. One, that blacks were just heathens, that they were not civilized beings, that they were barbarians, and that they were outcasts from the earth. And one thing that I heard being, I'm not Lutheran, I'm Southern Baptist, and so I heard this pretty much all my life, that this whole debate about are black people really descendants of Ham, Noah's son, and were blacks really kind of outcasts from the earth, and is that why we have such hard lives, and is that why the racial situation is not getting any better? So that whole justification became black people are kind of descendants of Noah's son Ham, and so therefore this justifies the slavery that we're putting them into. The second theory was that blacks were biologically inferior to whites. That, you know, because of whatever reason, we just were not as good as white folks. We were not as smart. We were not physically as capable of doing a number of things. And so this was really kind of the direction that the founding fathers took off in. When you talk about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, they talked about all men being created equal, but then they also said that blacks were not men. And so the compromise became that if you were a slave owner and you wanted to vote, the compromise was that you would count all of the black slaves that you owned as 3/5 of a person, not a whole person. Okay? So with this developed what a number of people call beliefs with a purpose. And I think that's important that we kind of focus in on beliefs with a purpose. You know, because a whole system of beliefs were established, and they had a very clear purpose, and the clear purpose was to justify bad treatment of a group of people. And that raises another issue that I don't even want you to answer out loud, but to really think about as I kind of open this up for discussion, and that is, because blacks were considered inferior, the issue or the question then becomes raised: if you mix blacks with whites, do you have a superior being to the regular black, or do you have an inferior being to the regular black? So I don't want you to answer that question, but just kind of think about it as we talk about this. Because if you believe that the above is true, then you can see where some of the problems would come about that even happen in today's society. I can give you very clear examples, for example, of, and one time as a school project, I went back and I looked at all of the slave auctions. And certainly, lighter skinned blacks, mulatto blacks, brought more in terms of money when they were being sold in auction, so that they had a value that was greater than the darker skinned black person in this country. And they were also a lot of times what were called the field, that the house servants, that certain servants worked in the house, wore kind of the master's hand-me-down clothes, got to eat the table scraps from the master's, where the darker skinned blacks, for the most part, were in the fields doing the heavy labor and not getting any of those other benefits. And so what we have is, even to this day, a series of people, a number of people, and a number of ways that it works itself out in today's society, of this whole colorism issue. You know, for example, when I often hear whites talk about a beautiful black woman, and let me be real honest with you, I think Lena Horne is a beautiful black woman, no doubt about it. But I often wonder if they think she's a beautiful black woman because she's beautiful, or do they think she's a beautiful black woman because she looks white, almost, you know? And I don't see them saying, for example, Cicely Tyson is a beautiful black woman. And I hear a lot of surprise when I tell people that Cicely Tyson broke the color line in terms of black models. She was a very high-paid top fashion model, and people seem to be shocked by that, you know, that here's this woman, dark skin, black features, wore an afro very early on in her modeling career, and still brought, you know, big money in as a model. So you all want to just kind of open it up for discussion or questions or anything like that?
Are you allowed Margaret and I to talk?
Yes.
I can let the listener too.
Be quiet. I mean, don't be quiet.
Was Cicely did her big bucks in Europe first?
Yes. And that becomes, and that also becomes another issue.
You got affirmed elsewhere.
You had to.
You came back with credentials.
That's right.
You had to go outside of this society.
And another thing that people do is to say that when you look at a beautiful person of color, that they're exotic.
Yeah.
Not really realizing that is not a compliment.
And she was an economic commodity.
Right.
Oh, she was first in a community of color in the 40s and 50s and the 60s. It was the same thing. If you were lighter, you were more accepted. You were, quote unquote, better. The 60s turned it around with Black Power, and then it kind of flipped around. And the darker you are, the bigger, the fuzzier your afro, you became, in community's eyes, you know, a better person. I'm not sure, Roy and I were having this discussion, I'm not sure where it lies now.
This is very interesting, because I had a young woman who's biracial in my class last year, and she really felt that she had experienced a lot of color prejudice because she was so fair-skinned. And she interviewed about 50 people while she was in Chicago, and found some things that it wasn't a scientific study, but it was just interesting to me. The first thing that she found out, which was really interesting to me, because she said, I'd like to interview some quote-unquote older women. So that's what people And how she classified older women was even more shocking.
Yeah.
The women over 30. So now I know I'm really old. You know, she brought that home. And she said the high school students felt that there was very much a color barrier. That it was that they felt that fair-skinned black girls, for example, and this was mostly centered around women, got more dates, asked out more, were seen as being prettier, and a whole lot of other things, kind of privilege of color kinds of things that the darker skinned girls did not get. However, she asked them the question, if you could change, would you change your skin color? None of the darker skinned girls said yes. Mm-hmm. And about half of the fairer skinned girls said, yes, we would change.
Darker.
Yes, we would become darker. Mm-hmm. But they did not say how much darker, which is another issue.
You know, Dorothy, it's really interesting. I have a friend, and she's lighter complexity, and she lost her husband. And during her most intense time of grief, we would be talking, and she would often make a comment, because here she felt that, you know, she had a loss. She was a woman, and she was quite young at the time, and certainly she wanted a companion, and being the professional black woman, she said, it's really difficult for me to find someone that I could really appreciate. And she says, and then she says, it just seemed as if the dark black women have the best husbands. Mm-hmm. And we had this conversation. I said, what do you mean by that? She says, it just seemed as if everything happens good to the to the darker black woman. And for months we continued this conversation, and it was the first that I had heard. Growing up in the South, I was very much aware of this color caste system, and then the Northwest in itself is something different for those of us of color, and she grew up in California, and that kind of that was very strange to me that she would make that comment, because you're absolutely right about the acceptability of lighter complected African Americans over darker complected African Americans.
And really, I'd like to hop onto that is to say, when Dorothy in an introductory comment said that there is a difference, or historically, how people of darker color are treated differently, and then the children that are biracial are treated differently. And I'd like to hear more about that. Maybe today, I don't think we have to go how far back, whatever you think is necessary, and by whom? By the black community, or by the white community, or by whom?
I think they're treated differently by both.
By both, yes.
Okay, that's what I would assume.
And it's part of the color caste system, and it's part of the theory of who you buy into. Now, I will say honestly that I came up through a time when, in my teenage years, of when it was the Black Power movement, and our philosophy, and in Chicago, I don't know if it was this way or anything else, but our philosophy was, if you had one drop of black blood, we used the definition that the slave person gave us, and that was that if you had one drop of black blood, you were black. Mm-hmm. And so we took it then that if you defined yourself as black, you were black, and you were not going to be questioned by that. But at the same time, I realized in that time, we had very strong fair-skinned people, in addition to very strong dark-skinned people in the movement and very vocal. So it would be very hard, for example, to attack fair-skinned blacks when you have a Malcolm X with hazel eyes and or gray eyes and red hair, or an Angela Davis, or a Martin Luther King. So colorism was not as strong during the time when I came up. When I said that to this young woman, she was just absolutely shocked. And she said, I've experienced it all my life, and I just really don't know, can't imagine, would like to be able to say that I could walk into a room and say I'm black and be accepted. You know, and so she had that problem. And then there was some anger. Yeah, well, you can't, you might not be able to walk into a room and get accepted, but you can walk into a room and we can both go in and you'll get a job before I will. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's jealousy, that's survival. Yes.
But the basis of it and the reason that we really need to examine it is because of its historical perspective. Mm-hmm. And it is doing exactly what it was intended to do, create a caste system and to keep people who are at the bottom fighting among each other. Mm-hmm. And we really need to know that and examine that so that we don't feed into it. And we still do continue to feed into it. And one of the things I asked the students to do was to give me some examples of the kind of stereotypical things that they saw in terms of color. And mostly, again, it revolves around women because it revolves around this whole issue of beauty. You know? So, for example, if Anne Marie had a little short nose, would she be as attractive? Or if her lips were wider, would she be as attractive as she is now?
Well, it's making these movie stars a little more acceptable. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hitting whatever they do to make their lips thicker and,
oh, I know,
and more fuller. Well, I don't want to throw out my ethnocentricity, but, you know, I just always feel that black is really beautiful, you know.
What about Jackson, entertainer?
Michael
Jackson. Yeah. Now, he has gone to quite an extreme in his...
Exactly, is it? And it is very hard for you to grow up in today's society seeing the kinds of emphasis that we put on beauty, mm-hmm. seeing how beauty is defined, mm-hmm. you know, and not wondering why. And of course we do. We do see women this skin color who have blonde hair because they believe that it will make them look beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we see women with blue contact lenses. That seems to be a rage now. Change your eye color, you know. So we see kind of all of these things play out. And they also play, and they play out very interesting in very interesting ways, especially in the black community. I have six brothers and sisters, and we range the whole range of the color spectrum. And we have developed a good sense of humor about this because I have been with my sister and at her job, and she works in corporate America, and she said, you know, I want to introduce you to my sister. And I sit like this. Where is she, Diane? You know, so there, you know, there.
Well, I have a personal experience because my very first boyfriend, my college sweetheart, and to me, that was my very first love, the very first time I didn't date when I was in high school. I didn't date as a freshman in college, my sophomore year. I met this BMOC, and we were, I was smitten. I was a sophomore, and we dated until I became a senior. And he was a year ahead of me, so he graduated, and he got a teaching position outside of where we were in college, and he would come back, and we were still dating. And of course, at that time, when the pressure was on that you got your man before you left college, I just knew I had my man. He went off to teach, and then there came that time he came to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And it was the time that he told me that he had met someone who was also a teacher. And I'll never forget it. He said, I really do love you, but I have to think about the eugenics of the children. Mm. Mm.
The what?
The eugenics.
Genetics.
He was also a dark-complected young man, and my being a dark-complected young lady, the eugenics of the children meant that they would be the dark-complected from his perspective. I can't tell you the hurt. My mother and I talked about it. She says, years from now, you won't even remember his name. Well, I do. But those are the kinds of things that we have to deal with.
Certainly in the 40s. And certainly in the 40s, if you look at this issue, there was a trend of not marrying anyone darker than you. Mm-hmm. Because what you really wanted to do was lighten the color of your brother. And so you deliberately looked for someone who was of a fairer skin complexion than you.
So they would have a better chance.
So that they would have a better chance of moving up the social ladder. And I have a very kind of interesting personal experience that I can relate. My daughter, when she was born, I kind of went crazy looking for family tree stuff. And so I went to her grandmother's house and was looking through family albums because I have a long hallway, and down this hallway are all of our ancestors now, pictures of our ancestors. And I got to her grandfather, a photo of him. Her great-grandmother is still living. Her great-grandmother is 99. And her great-grandfather died last year. I looked at a picture and I said, "Who is this man?" And she said, "Oh, that's Grandpa and his brother." And I said, "Did he die young?" And she said, "No, he was very fair-skinned, like her great-grandfather was. He moved to California. He changed his name to Felipe instead of Phillips, and he passed for Hispanic. And so he literally cut himself off from the family, and he passed, which was another very bad consequence of colorism, that people passed so that they could get accepted into society, and by doing that had to cut themselves off from all of their roots, all of their family, all of their heritage, and just really start anew.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, go ahead.
No. Well, I'm sure there are million stories. I try to be succinct, but just to give you an idea, we have two daughters and a son. The one daughter and her husband took the other daughter's children to church with them on one Sunday. And in the introductions, they made them, and then their cousins, and two by one daughter and two by another. And later, the family came up to the one daughter, my daughter, and said, "Who are those children?" And she said, "Well, they're my sister and her husband's children." And she says, well, of course they're adopted, aren't they? And of course, you know by now that they are biracial, and our son-in-law is African-American. And, you know, that was, it's been a painful and yet growing thing that this is, this generation, and yet there's some, you know, well, anyway, I could go on and on, but if anybody wants to talk to me anytime, it's been the most wonderful thing that's happened in our family. Wonderful.
I think one of the most difficult parts of this whole question is hidden prejudice or unconscious prejudice.
All right. And that's why I bring the issue of colorism up, because it's often very hidden. It's often things that you don't think about, but that you kind of do.
Educated whites honestly believe that there's no difference in intellectual, difference between blacks and whites. But without their knowledge, I think subconsciously, there is a prejudice there, and they don't admit it.
I was just talking to a friend the other day, and I was saying, it's right along these lines, that I've always considered myself not to be prejudiced. You know, I grew up in Africa, in Ethiopia, and I was always a minority, you know, but always, I just always have thought, well, I'm not prejudiced. And I certainly think, you know, well, there's of course no difference other than skin. Well, I should, that's not acknowledging that there are some very important, wonderful cultural differences. But I was saying, I mean, I feel kind of ashamed to admit this, but, you know, when I lived in Boston for a while, and particularly in Boston, because it was a bigger city, you know, if I'm walking down the street alone in the city, I feel more cautious if it's two black men walking toward me than two white men. And, you know, I mean, I justify it in a million zillion ways. To, well, it's because socioeconomically, you know, there are people who are of color in a community that's primarily a black community. They aren't able to have the same educational experiences because of white people keeping them down. You know, the whole thing is, so therefore there's more crime, and therefore it's a different thing that I'm in more danger. You know, but so what do I do about that? You know, how do I get beyond that? I mean, I don't know. So in that way, I am prejudiced, and I hate thinking about that, but if I don't admit it, then I can't
exactly
deal with it.
So I think the first step is that you recognize it and you admit it, and so it then comes from something that is not conscious into something that is conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore now you can do something about it.
Right.
But as long as, I mean, you can talk to people a long time about things that they think that they don't do.
Mm-hmm.
And until they really realize that they do it, you're wasting your time.
Mm-hmm.
My mother realized in the late 60s when Billy and I got married that she was racially prejudiced. And she didn't believe it. Almost to the point where she refused to come in the way. And it bothered her so that it stuck up the colitis reaction to her she'd had it before, but it was another stimulant to that process. That she and we had one conversation driving in a car as I was driving her up to the wedding, basically. She did come, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, I just didn't believe I was that way. It so disturbed her. Her whole psyche, her whole mm-hmm. spiritual perspective, being a minister's wife, and all this thing. She took me in 1951 on a train ride from northern Michigan to Florida, you know, and taught me how awful racial prejudice was.
Right.
Pointing out she was a great
mm-hmm.
teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but out of her own inevitable, we're all racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned to a principal friend of mine that I'm dealing with my racism about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
His mouth dropped open. What do you mean? You're married to a black woman, et cetera, et cetera. I said, I'm not aware of it sometimes, of how natural it comes into being, and I got to work terribly hard at that.
And we do have to work terribly hard mm-hmm. at racism, sexism, classism in this country.
And the problem is that the media and the culture around us keeps reinforcing it.
That's right.
And so as we're trying to change and we're trying to say, you know, I believe this, and then we're getting all this other stuff coming at us. And so, I mean, I feel that as a, you know, starting college and trying to
trying to deal with that and just getting all these messages, you know, from my textbooks at school to the classes that I'm expected to take. It's just keeping reinforced.
It's a socialization too. And I think largely it starts in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Retiring from the schools after 20 years and observing both the socialization of kids and staff, it's just really, really clear to me that even in our schools, as much as we profess the integration of it, it perpetuates itself. And we have in Tacoma what we call magnet schools, where we employ the middle class European American kids to come into the low economic and here again, all of the goodies go to those kids,
mm-hmm.
and those same characteristics that, you know, people of color, and we have lots of Native American. I worked at one school that was on a Native American reservation. And who gets treated the worst? And attitude. There are those who really, you know, 99.44% of staff would say, I am not prejudiced. But they don't know how they pass that on,
mm-hmm.
Even to kids. And time and time again, you know, we've had to deal with that. The more comfortable staff became with me, because there again, that fear, the more comfortable they came to me, we could talk about it. It was less threatening, and it did make a difference, because when I talk about the kids' problems and why maybe they're the way they are, then they would take another look at how they dealt with them. Mm-hmm. But I was always very uncomfortable with how kids are treated, how the socialization began. If there is a conflict between black and white students, who gets sent home the most? The black student. Whose fault is it that it happened? The black student. And there's only one side to the matter. And I think the way we socialize ourselves, I want to tell another personal story. It's when Ted talked about working and struggling with his own racism, because in a situation of two professionals, one being an African-American woman and him, and he's called, they are in the same capacity in this school. And Ted comes and he's very disturbed about what's happening, what he sees. And I says, well, you know, being very objective, we can talk about it. And I think that rather than take sides, we can be objective about situations and look at, you know, the undercurrents of those and deal with situations better. I don't want to take over.
I was thinking about this yesterday. I said, why did you start off with this one in terms of your racism awareness series? And I said to myself, subconsciously, you are deliberately backing into racism. And so I did not do that consciously, but I think subconsciously I did not want to start off really talking about hardcore racism, wanting to back into it, you know, and so I kind of think, but I think that the subtle things that happen, the subtle things that we see are very important.
I have a question. If you put an Indian, an Asian, and a black in the room, and you wonder, of the three, who would be the one that would be the least discriminated, or the most discriminated against of the three? Now, Indians are going through it. See, I'm in the Northwest here, and I don't live too far from Indian Reservation. And then a lot of Asians are also around there, too. And gradually, we're getting more and more blacks coming in. But we have mostly Asians, it seems like. But I often wondered, of all the three of them, who would be the one that would be the most discriminated against. It's something I really haven't really thought about much. But that would be a good thing to think about.
Well, we have all kinds of discrimination, and basically there's no difference, you know. We have
We have the age issues. We have the people with disability issues, whether they're physical or mental. And we have the various color and ethnic issues. And basically how they interact and how they're discriminated against, the process is the same across the board.
The process is the same, but I think that race brings another layer to it. Yeah, it brings another layer to it. And I often have, I'll give you a good example of what I mean. I work with the Associated Colleges of the Midwest. And oftentimes when I go to a place and I know that I'm going to be the only black person there, and I can gear myself up for the battle because I know the battle's going to come, and I gear myself up mentally and physically, and I know that I'm going to have to go there and argue and fight, you know, for whatever it is. But I walked into this committee of women's concerns, and they were all, for the most part, white feminists, strong feminists on their campus, doing things, moving and shaking, good social histories, active in a whole lot of issues. And what they decided to do was a series of focus groups to find out what the problems were on campuses of these 14 different colleges. And when they came back with their focus groups a year later, they didn't have any women of color in the focus groups. How did this happen? Well, I don't know how it happened, but we do have enough that we can go on. And I said, wait. We cannot go on. And so there I am fighting this group of progressive women, feminist women, who intellectually agree that they have got to fight racism as vigorously as they fight sexism, but who have done this. And to have to argue with them for 2 hours about the issue of you cannot go on until you get the women of color's voice, you know? And, you know, so there are times when, race adds that layer. Also in the homosexual community, another issue where racism is a very strong just factor in seeing how people are treated.
Well, and I agree with what you say, and I just want to take it one way I look at it, and have looked at it for a while. Inequity to one is inequity to all. And I operate by that.
I think that's true, and I think, I guess my philosophy is when you see oppression, you have to fight it wherever it is. Unfortunately, we have to also realize that, and I think everybody has to do it, we have to realize that we also can oppress, even though we are oppressed.
I think we've been lulled into thinking that the ethnic, racial, particularly racial aspects is pretty well over with now. We seem to, I see this side, we go into, gee, we're to work on this and fix it, we're to work on this and fix it, and we fixed that in the 60s and 70s, and not knowing how socialized we've become, and I see some fresh possibilities. I've been living on the 60s and 70s in my own way of perceiving things, and I've got to take a look at it now in another fresh way. And race must be included in the process, and it tends to be easy now to deal with all these others. And it's all part of the mix. I think it's a healthy time for growth here at this point.
One of the things that I do, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I've worked in the high school for quite a few years, and I was a cook in the school, but I also had a special job in the a la carte room, and I used students to help me. And two of my best workers and the best girls I've really ever got acquainted with were black girls, and they were so good, but they were very, very popular also because they really got into it. And they were very popular with the students, and it was good to have them there, really. They were very good. And that was quite an experience. I hated to see them leave, really.
I think that for us in the Lutheran Church, income issues are really mixed in there, too.
Yes.
I live in Albuquerque, and we have a 2% black population. We have a 40% Hispanic population, and more Native Americans who actually call themselves Indians in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. And we don't touch it. We do not. I'm a pastor, and we do not touch it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it becomes very easy to just forget about it. Mm-hmm.
the issue of income?
And to get real, well, income and race. I mean, there are a whole bunch of, there are a lot of things mixed together. Mm-hmm.
There are.
And a lot of it is related, I mean, in it some is. Complicated ways. But my congregation remains middle class, upper middle class, blonde hair, blue eye mm-hmm. for the most part. People who marry in are part of the congregation.
I think racism is an economic thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think we perpetuate it through economics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And housing patterns, very much there.
Yeah.
Jobs. And we can see it with affirmative action and what, you know, and all of the hate and all of the hostility out of that,
mm-hmm.
And all of the talk of reverse discrimination, mm-hmm. when less than 2% of those who have been not privileged getting jobs. And then once they get the jobs, it's a tear, and you're not qualified. I mean, we look at a variety of ways in which that we are prejudiced and racist, and I think it's built up, you know, the have and the have-not society in which we live.
Along this issue, I've thought about it quite a bit, and I've seen the suburban communities and the kind of communities they're talking about. What I'd like to see is a church that sends their people out and say, don't come back as members until you bond with somebody in another community.
But you know, even before you can do that, mm-hmm. part of our program is we have an urban placement. Before we can really send students out into a community, they have to suspend judgment. Mm-hmm. They have to suspend judgment on where they're going, on people's culture, on values, and go in and appreciate the value of what they're getting. And they also have to realize that they are coming in with a position of privilege. And position and privilege and power are very important. And they have to realize that. And that's one of the hardest things that I have to do. I have to stand up in front of a group of very wealthy, for the most part, white students from private liberal arts colleges and say to them that you have some very racist things that you do, you have been doing them for a long time, you need to look at the privilege and power that you hold just because you are white in America. No other reason. And the struggle that comes with that, because there are lots of times when I see students and they want to say to me, truly, they're excited for the first 3 weeks. But after the first 3 weeks, they want to move on. Mm-hmm. Now, we've done enough on this racism stuff. Let's move on to something else. Isn't there something else we can talk about?
I've heard said that the blacks prefer the open prejudice of the South to the hidden prejudice of the North. Is that true?
I've heard people say that over and over again. At least you know, at least you know where you stand.
I prefer it that way.
Yeah. I thought so.
I prefer it that way.
Yeah. At least you know where you stand.
Yes. Yeah. And open.
Uh-huh.
Know where you are.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I can pick up on that underlying current of racism every time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Through the smile mm-hmm. and the positive talk in front of my face.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what's mm-hmm. happening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I visited University of Virginia, which is where I'm going to, and it is in the South, the girl that I stayed with was black, or African American, and she came from Philadelphia. And I asked her, "What was there a difference in moving to Virginia?" Because she was in Charlottesville, Virginia. And around Charlottesville, Virginia, it's fairly, well, redneck area. There is, you don't want to go outside Charlottesville because there's not much outside of it. And so I asked her if there was a difference there, and she said that there was some, and I asked her, you know, how she dealt with it, and she said that, you know, she sort of had a sixth sense about when there was going to be a problem or when things were starting to go wrong, that she said it's something you sort of unconsciously learn to be aware in situations. And the only thing that I could relate it to with being female and having to be aware in certain situations, like not going outside at night alone, mm-hmm. or just, you know, watching out in certain conversations or with certain people.
But I think that what will happen is as you go to the University of Virginia, if that environment is there, you will find yourself making some very difficult decisions. Some of the decisions that I hear my students talk about. So what do you do when the racist joke is made? What do you do when your friend isn't invited to join the sorority and you are? What do you do if that is your friend when you continue to get the privilege and she doesn't, and it becomes very obvious that you have the privilege and she doesn't? And how do you deal with that? And it's something that will be very difficult for you to deal with. And you know, no one can tell you how to do it. You have to make the decisions about what's important to you and how to deal with it. And that'll be a very difficult time.
Dorothy, when you say suspend judgment, and after about 3 weeks, the realities go on, what are some of the, one way that is a lot of this?
We go into a different, I teach a course on Chicago neighborhoods, and so we go into different neighborhoods, and we meet with different community leaders, and some of them are very poor, who speak very broken English, and some of them are black, and some of them are Hispanic, and there's Native Americans, and there's Asians, and we get people, and we have them talk about their neighborhood, the struggle in their neighborhood, and what they're doing about the issues that are happening in their neighborhood. And for the first 3 weeks, they are fascinated. And then after that, they say, we're tired of hearing about racism. When are you going to get on something else? Why don't you have a speaker speak about something else besides racism? And then I say, never ask a speaker to speak about racism. Never said to a speaker, would you come in and tell my students how racist Chicago is? I always ask them to come and talk about their neighborhood and the struggles and the issues that they're dealing with. So if everybody is telling you about racism, racism must be a problem. I am not slanting this. And here also comes in the racism, because I am a black woman. And it's very easy to dismiss me. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for these students to say, she's a black woman, she's cynical, she's jaded, and this is not true.
It's got an issue.
Yeah, and it's a whole thing of power and position, because I make them know very early on that I am from poverty. I fought my way through poverty, and I know that this is a very classist as well as racist society. And I also tell them how strongly I feel about coming out of poverty and what I've had to go through. And so it's very easy for them to say, this woman is so cynical, she shouldn't even be teaching a course. And around the second month, when we ask, who do you want to come in, they will say stuff like, a real Chicagoan. What's a real Chicagoan? Somebody who loves the city. Now let's wait a minute. I love the city. I grew up in the city. I was raised in the city. I raised my daughter in the city. And I can afford not to live in the city. I must love the city because I continue to live there. Now, why don't you think I love the city? Because you talk about the problems of the city. And then I say to them, look at the racist thing you have just said. You are telling me I cannot criticize the city. So, just like I cannot be American because I can't criticize the country, I cannot now be Chicagoan because I cannot criticize the city. What's wrong with this? And I know that I have colleagues who are not